Hello, and welcome to the No Good Poetry Podcast. Each week we talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly of poetry.
This is episode 7.
With
Joseph Bienvenu and
Joseph Makos.
This is the good, bad, and the ugly, isn't it? Some ugly shit out there, kids. Let's make the world safer for poetry.
Today we're going to talk about Edgar Allan Poe.
Poe and his obsession with language.
His obsession with language.
Through a really, dark time in American history, poetry canon. But we're going to, celebrate him. And we're going to talk about how our friend is working through some of his poetry and making musical compositions. And we're going to play a little bit of that.
Yeah, so our friend Jeff Pagano, last weekend, he had written two compositions based on Poe. One was based on the poem Lenore, and we'll play that one at some point during this episode. And one was, I think, just more generally about of his work. And he played that in some other pieces in New Orleans at the Children's Resource Library. And I went and read a couple of those poems, and we'll play some of those during the episode as well. And Jeff really likes Poe, and we'll kind of mention... I had a lot of discussions with him about it, and we'll talk a little bit about that as we go through this as well. Yeah,
late night discussion about Poe and how it inspires certain aesthetic and certain musical tonalities. We are going to come at you here with some. This is going to be a dynamic episode. It's going to have some recordings, some music, as we said, some poetry, and some readings from some archival materials.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Oh, we're in the episode. All right. So, I want to pull a couple of things here. There's a piece that I found, which is an article from the Daily Picayune Illustrated Sunday Magazine from the 12th of July, 1908, and it appears. After investigating and reading this article, it appears as though there was a resurgence of interest in Poe sometime right around 1908, which actually would have been a centennial celebration of his birth in 1809. And there's some interesting tidbits of information to put this into perspective for listeners. So, Tennyson, Miss Browning, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Edgar Allan Poe, Charles Darwin, William Ewart Gladstone, Abraham Lincoln, Kinglake, Edward Fitzgerald, Thomas Paine, Chopin, Mendelssohn, Monckton, Miles, were all born in 1809.
Oh, wow. It's a long list. I didn't know where you were going with that.
No, I know, but I think it's significant. It's significant to put it into context to understand, what time period we're looking at. Because I think sometimes people don't really, they kind of fumble over that part of the American, the 19th century, the American.
Well, it's a weird time for literature in America, I think.
Especially coming to the end of it. But, to put it into perspective, in the 100th anniversary of Poe, what we had is 1909. And I think what we're looking at here is that, it was a different world at that point. And I think, the avant-garde was starting to bud. So I think there was a sort of a resurgence of interest in his life. There was an organized effort here, it says, talks about, which made to sort of properly observe the anniversary of his birthday. And it said that 1908 was this sort of poverty year of literary celebrations compared with what was going on to be observed around his birthday. But that there was publications and there was other things that sort of came out around that time that sort of it ushered in a resurgence of interest in Poe.
So do you think part of that is, after Baudelaire did those translations of Poe into French, there was this real... sort of veneration of him by the French poets, by the French symbolists especially? Do you think that played some role in his kind of resurgence in America too? Do you think that maybe lent him some more credence that...
So like the American echo, or like understanding the American... Yeah, so you're saying that the attention that he gained overseas and how that played back into the interest of Poe on as sort of a cornerstone of world literature, not just as something that's just looked at as an American literary thing. It was something that was celebrated by poets and scholars outside of America. It must be. I mean, if you're translating and having a new translation of work that comes out, then it clearly is going to have a ripple effect on its place in literary canon.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, Poe was definitely fairly popular during his own lifetime. Although I think that he had a lot of critics as well, right? But I don't know how seriously he was taken as a writer, as part of like a literary establishment during his lifetime.
I mean, I don't know. I think I'm not exactly, you know, too up on how it was, but I mean, was it just like a regional thing more?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of there was a very sort of regional kind of literature at the time. I think it was difficult for anyone who wasn't part of kind of the New England scene of things.
Well, he was from Maryland, but he, you know, spent a lot of time in Boston. And although it's according to this,
he was kind of all over the place.
He considered himself a Virginian. That's what it says. I'm a Virginian, at least. I
think
he
moved around quite a bit.
But yeah, I mean, this is like the idea of what like historiography, right? Is like the idea of sort of like what he did in the time period that he lived in, and you know, judging poets and judging historical figures by the time they lived in is an interesting thing, because you have to do a lot of research and understand, you know, the perspectives of the people at the time and what the sort of like zeitgeist was, and like, was his poetry considered special or anything? You know, I mean, it's hard, you know, a lot of people like him don't really become famous until after. I mean, isn't that kind of how, you know?
Well, and I think with Poe, I mean, I think The Raven was pretty hugely successful in his lifetime. But other than that, I think his poetry was more panned than his fiction was, right? I think his fiction was probably more respected.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, it had been a while since I had really read Poe. There were certain things I remembered very fondly from reading them when I was younger. And I was just going back through my collected Poe to see what I wanted to read for this musical performance. And I was kind of a little bit shocked at how things seemed different to me than I remembered them.
Really?
I knew I kind of remembered not liking the poetry as much. I think more of my fond memories of Poe are about the fiction. But I did remember there being some poetry that I liked. And I mean, I have to be honest, I had a hard time finding poems to read. I did find some that I liked better than others. But the thing about Poe, right, is there's this very strange, like, magnetism about his poetry, even when it's not that good overall. There's something about the tone of it, this sort of romantic, filtered through pessimism.
Well, I'm just like
that's interesting, right?
Reading, yeah. A little bit of a recap of his life, and just here glossing over a few notes that I have, and looking at sort of how he flitted between different places, and you know, all his time that he spent, and basically, you know, this is interesting talking about at 18, a publisher took some of his poems and just basically published them without his real knowledge and interest, and that, you know, it was unsaleable when it came out at 18, but then, you know, by 1900, 50 years after his death, you know, what copy had sold for $2,050. It was an insane amount of money for that point in time to have a copy like that. But, you know, it said that he reached the height of his literary career in 1847. So he was from 1840 to 1847. So the 1840s were Poe's year, I guess. Poe's decade was that. And, you know, it just was this, like, idea that he was living the life of a poet, you know? And he was just, you know, being a romancer, but an editor, and a critic, and a writer, and all these sort of things. So, you know, it seems like he did it all. He had kind of like a weird last couple years of his life with his wife dying a couple years, and that kind of sent him into like a 2-year kind of disarray, I suppose, is what is sort of the summary of this article here that I'm reading about. But what's funny is that we looked at this article, and the title of the article is The Cheerless Poet. Poe, the Cheerless Poet. And, you know, it seems like I think the thing that we most know about Poe outside of the works that we read is this, like, glamorization of his story is this, like, you know, kind of, like, person who fell from grace, I guess, like, at the end of his life or something. And he, like...
Well, but I think he he kind of was always... poor and running in a crowd that was more rich than he was.
He
right?
was.
Yeah. I mean, wasn't that kind of the thing he's known for? Like, you see the pictures of him. He's always in these, yes, nice clothes, but they're always kind of frayed and shabby looking.
Yeah.
That's kind of the thing. I mean, part of that's the whole mythos of him, right? Of this kind of fallen elite or something, right?
Yeah. I mean, it seems like he is celebrated as being this, you know, this kind of like, you know, I don't even, it's like, not really like, it's kind of hard to follow. It's kind of hard to, like, you know, we have this, like, because it's like this is like resounding image of Poe, but it's always like harkens back to like the Raven. You know?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's all of those things. I mean, this fascination with kind of morbid subject matters, which is interesting, but dealing with them in a less romanticized fashion than maybe the kind of Victorian sensibility of mourning and all of that would be. But he's kind of just got this image of being an outsider, right? Of being someone outside of the literary mainstream in some way.
Yeah, I wonder why, what triggered, and as I've read this article, it doesn't really quite say, but it basically was just sort of like this resurgence of Poe scholarship that happened around his 100th anniversary of his birth, and that was basically what brought him back.
Yeah, well, I think at the time, both the popularity of Poe that he did have and the difficulty that he had was he was doing something so different in some ways from other poets that were going on, there was a lot of backlash to that on some level.
I don't know much about, like, his 18. Well, I mean, you know, being, I don't know, like, his 18. I mean, you think about when he's writing, man.
Well, it's
think
a weird
about,
like, time.
What the world is like.
It's a weird time,
you know,
for
think about
American
when America's
literature,
like,
especially, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think when I was looking at his poetry, that's part of the difficulty I have with Poe and his poetry is I do see him imitating a lot of European poetry in a way that to me is sometimes sloppy and I have a hard time with. As much as I think he's doing other things that are just kind of wonderful and weird, he doesn't seem to be aware of what he's doing well and what he's doing poorly. If that makes sense.
So he's just powering through it and just writing and...
Well, I think he's, like, trying to forge a new form in some way for American poetry, but he's trying to build it out of this European framework. And there's this kind of weird clash and disconnect that happens. And I think the disconnect is worse in his poetry than it is in his fiction. I think it's less of a problem in the fiction. The fiction maybe gave him a little more of a way to come away from that. I mean, one person that's interesting to think about, I mean, it's interesting to think about other poets and what they thought of Poe's poetry too. And maybe one of the more interesting people to think about is T.S. Eliot, because he had kind of a complicated relationship with what he thought of Poe's poetry. In some ways it was negative, but I can't say that I disagree with some of it. But he kind of changed a little bit over time because he recognized there was still something there. He said about Poe that he had slipshod writing and puerile thinking and haphazard experiments, which is not very positive there. But he kind of had this kind of conflict because he loved Baudelaire and he loved the French symbolists so much. And he was like, well, but maybe I must be missing something. Because if Baudelaire saw something here, I must be missing something here. And he could recognize that there was something original in what Poe was doing. But it was just hard for him to get past some of the sloppiness of... And I kind of feel like that, too. Some of the poems, it's like, oh, I really like... This is a long set of lines I really like. And then he does something really amateurish.
Bring it right back down.
Which is odd, right? I don't know. What are your thoughts on Poe's poetry in general?
I think that it's... again, I see it as kind of a light in the tunnel of that time period of his poetry. Like, I think it's like, what else? Tell me something else from the 1830s or 40s.
Well, yeah, it's a hard thing. What's going on? I like it better than Longfellow.
For sure.
You know? it's weird, though, because I feel like he was trying to break out of what was going on, but then he does things, and he does these goofy things. Like, what's that poem he has where these experimentations, I suppose he would call them, but where it's like the whole poem, it's like this thing talking to a lady, and then it's like, now figure out the name of the person I'm talking to, and you need to read like the first letter of the first line, the second letter of the second line, the third letter of the
really
third
like
line,
an acrostic, some weird acrostic.
But it's more complicated because it's like you need to keep going up a number every line.
Weird.
But he did all kinds of stuff like that, which I think is part of what rubbed Eliot the wrong way, because there's this kind of pretension happening there, this kind of trying to put on some air of erudition. It's strange, right? But then his best stuff doesn't do that. But then but even a lot of his good poems have these moments of that in the middle of it where you're like, well, you slip into this.
So he sits, yeah. He hits something good.
Yeah. And then, like, looking at what Eliot said, then there's this idea, too, that he's like, well, oh, I'm going to say this wrong. He says, you know, what the French symbolists like about him was that he had this idea of being le poète maudit, right? The rebel poet, right? That kind of idea.
So,
and that's definitely, I think, still what people like about Poe, right? They like this idea of people who don't like poetry, but they like this sort of fact that there's something kind of anti-society, anti-America in particular, in Poe's sensibility.
Yeah.
Right, that appeals to them.
In this dark kind of like thing that he was like, I don't even know. Like, I just think maybe Poe was doing a resistance, you know. It's like isn't that like some good poetry in certain time periods of American literature? It's like a little bit of a resistance. Like, he was breaking against the form and structure the best he could with what he had. But the thing is with Poe's poetry, especially looking at this anthology and seeing that, you know, there's 100 pages of poetry and like 500 pages of other stuff. Not even. It's like 80 pages of poetry.
But he did poetry first. Like, that was his initial thing. Like, he was like, I'm a poet. And then he moved to doing more
fiction.
Prose later.
Right.
Well, and not just fiction, a lot of, like, magazine writing, and he did satire, and he did, which some of which is super weird and interesting. But there is something there. There's something different there that's not in other poetry. And would I rather read even his poetry, which is not always the best, would I rather read a Poe poem than a Longfellow poem every single time? Absolutely. Part of it is the time period, right? Okay, and here's something positive Eliot did say, and it does have to do with this fact of the time period. You're in a time period where you're kind of, there's not a lot of great literature going on in America, right?
We're talking 1840s again, 1830s, 1840s.
Yeah, so this is what Eliot says. Well, and this is funny. He actually regretted this later, that he said this, because he felt bad that he down-talked these other two people that he mentioned. But he says, Hawthorne, Poe, and Whitman are all pathetic creatures.
Ooh.
They are none of them so great as they might have been. But the lack of intelligent literary society is not responsible for their shortcomings. It is much more certainly responsible for some of their merits. The originality, if not the full mental capability of these men, was brought out, forced out by the starved environment. The originality gives them a distinction which some heavyweight authors do not obtain.
Huh.
And I think there is some truth to that. They're in this, I mean, you're looking at that landscape of literature at the time, and I think calling it a starved environment is fair, right?
That is pretty fair. That's what we said. That's what we said like 20 minutes ago in the podcast.
Yeah.
If nothing's happening in the canon, then you reach to find the thing that's the most, you know, the most different of the time, whatever.
And I also think the other part he's saying is probably true for all of them, but maybe especially for Poe, that on the one hand, his talent is greater than his work actually shows. But on the other hand, would the originality, would those good parts of his work were probably formed in the same way by being so starved from other literary society and being able to have that kind of nourishing growth, it caused some negative elements to his writing, but it also probably caused some of the weird, wonderful idiosyncrasies of his writing at the same time.
Yeah.
I
don't know. Poe, I mean, I think we could chalk it up. I think we could chalk it up there. In my opinion, we could chalk it up to this whole idea of just like, okay, Poe is this anomaly for this time period in which he lived, and that's why we celebrate him in a certain way, because it's this, you know, hero kind of worship. And I mean, I think we know that the poetry is not as,
but there is something there too, I think. And when we hear some of these recordings, I think there is also something there that is good, but it's just not totally there. I think maybe that's what bothers me about Poe, is I can see the great things sitting underneath the surface, but he never quite figured it out, especially with the poetry. He never quite figured out the stuff he was doing well. He was maybe developing it. I don't know. I wonder if he would have lived longer, he would have been able to develop that into a more fully formed type of literature.
River, and guide to bear, hast thou no tear?
now or nevermore. Sion, yon drear and rigid mere, low lies thy love, Lenore. Come, let the burial rite be read, the funeral song be sung, an anthem for the queenliest dead that ever died so young, a dirge for her, the doubly dead, in that she died so young. Wretches, ye loved her for her wealth and hated her for her pride, and when she fell in feeble health, ye blessed her that she died. How shall the ritual then be read? The requiem how be sung? By you, by yours, the evil eye, by yours, the slanderous tongue, that did to death the innocents that died and died so young. Pecawimus, but rave not thus, and let a Sabbath song go up to God so solemnly the dead may feel no wrong. The sweet Lenore hath gone before, with hope hath gloomed aside, leaving thee wild for the dear child that should have been thy bride. For her, the fair and debonair, that now so lowly lies, the life upon her yellow hair, but not within her eyes. The life still there upon her hair, the death upon her eyes. Avaunt, tonight my heart is light. No dirge will I upraise, but wrath the angel on her flight, the pan of all days. Let no bell toll, lest her sweet soul amidst hallowed mirth should catch the notes as it doth float up from the damned earth. Friends above, from fiends below, the indignant ghost is riven from hell into a high estate far up within the heaven. From grief and groan to the golden throne beside the king of heaven.
And you know who loves Poe? To go back to a former episode, William Carlos Williams.
Okay.
And have you ever read his essay, his collection of essays in The American Green?
Oh, I have read some of that.
And he has an essay on Poe in there. And he loves Poe, and he really defends him, and kind of is upset that he's often disparaged.
Yeah.
And Whitman liked Poe as well. Although he said, let's see, where's the Poe thing here? What year was that article that you were reading?
It was from 1909.
Okay, so this is 1875. I guess this is like, you know, Whitman did all those newspaper articles and things.
Yep.
He went to Baltimore for this reburial of Poe's remains in 1875.
Whitman did?
Yeah.
Wow.
And he ended up kind of talking about it a little bit, and he said while he was there, for a long while and until lately, I had a distaste for Poe's writings.
Wow.
I wanted and still want for poetry the clear sun shining and fresh air blowing, the strength and power of health, not of delirium, even amid the stormiest passions, with always the background of the eternal moralities. Non-complying with these requirements, Poe's genius has yet conquered a special recognition for itself, and I, too, have come to fully admit it and appreciate it in him.
So he finally came to see something.
But I think there's this thing about Poe with that. I mean, I think it's hard as a poet to look at Poe's poetry and not be like, ugh, ooh, that's sloppy, you know? But there's something still there. And it's weird. I mean, you have people like Whitman and Williams and Baudelaire feeling ultimately that those positive things outweigh the sloppy things.
He overlooked it.
Yeah, I don't think that it's that he overlooked it. I think it's just, although he saw the weaknesses in his writing, he just felt like the positive things outweighed them so much that he still respected the greatness of his writing in some way.
Again, maybe not reading the T.S. Eliot stuff, because that didn't come until 50 years after him, after Whitman's read. But you're talking about Whitman's read.
Yeah.
You're talking about Whitman's take on it, right? Because Whitman's kind of, Whitman's, I guess, accepting the that end of the portal of Poe. I mean, you know, he's accepting that end of the whole thing. He's like swallowing the pill, saying basically like, well, okay, Poe is valuable to me too, after all. I don't know. That's kind of what Whitman's saying, right?
Yes. But you also have this kind of, you know, but Baudelaire too. Although I think some people say, well, I kind of like that stuff. But like Baudelaire loved Poe, right? And that was a big thing that he did, was translating Poe into French. Although a lot of people say his translations are better than the original works a lot of the time.
Wow.
But
has anyone translated Baudelaire the French back from the French back into English?
I don't know. I mean, that would be interesting. But I think part of it for Baudelaire, right, is it's tied up with this philosophy, right? Part of it's this idea of what the French symbolists were trying to do, and they saw this as kind of this, you know, you've got Fleur de Mal, and you're like, okay, looking at the dark corners of society and embracing that as a refutation of this sort of moralistic view of the world, right? And you can see why that is appealing. And maybe it's hard for us to see that now because we're so far away from that, but maybe that was more revolutionary at the time. And it's hard for us to understand that now in some way.
Well, I mean, again, the 1840s, man. What are we supposed to... Don't we have to know a lot about what was really going on in the 1820s, 30s, 40s?
Well, I mean, but I mean, even knowing it, I think it's hard to... I don't know. You know, I think even knowing it, kind of, it's hard to understand what that is actually like, right?
Yeah.
The structuredness of that society is so far removed from where we're at now.
True. That we don't have really have much frame of reference for it?
Yeah.
No. Tricky.
It is tricky.
Well, yeah. I think maybe we said enough. I don't know. I don't know how we're going to edit this down because it's like such a laggy little...
I kind of wanted to give some of this Huxley thing too, though, but maybe it's too much. He's pretty rough on him here, though. But it is kind of interesting with the French stuff. Oh, man.
What is he... Okay.
Listen to what he says. Well, first of all, his article... This is vulgarity. His essay, Vulgarity in Literature. And it starts out with, was Edgar Allan Poe a major poet? It would surely never occur to any English-speaking critic to say so.
Huh.
And then he goes on, you know, a bit. But to get to the French stuff, he says, you know, we who are speakers of English and not English scholars, who were born into the language and from childhood, have been pickled in its literature. We can only say with all due respect that Baudelaire, Mallarmé, and Valéry are wrong, and that Poe is not one of our major poets. A taint of vulgarity spoils for the English reader all but two or three of his poems. The Marvelous City in the Sea and To Helen, for example, whose beauty and crystal perfection make us realize as we read them what a very great artist perished on most of the occasions when Poe wrote verse. And then he goes on to say, Not being English, they're incapable of appreciating those finer shades of vulgarity that ruin Poe for us, just as we, not being French, are incapable of appreciating those finer shades of lyrical beauty which are for them the making of La Fontaine.
So, he's saying that Poe's prettier in French.
Yeah.
And that's just how it works. almost like everything's prettier in French. Not quite, but...
And I do, I mean, there is something to that, I guess. But he still acknowledges that there are some good poems there, that there's this weird otherworldly beauty, right? He says that crystal, what did he say for that, you know, the beauty and crystal perfection. And I do think the poems of his that work better, that's part of what it is. It does have this kind of otherworldly quality to it, and part of it is this kind of strange artificiality that's dreamlike, right? Which is kind of nice. And you can see how that's appealing to the symbolist too, because that's a nice, that's something they were kind of aiming for, was this sort of dreamlike state, this sort of state of, and that's, I think, something Baudelaire talked about. You know, he has that thing on being drunk, where he kind of romanticizes the idea of being drunk and this idea of writing where you get to escape your senses and go to another world. And I think he was one of the ones who really pushed for this romanticized notion of Poe's drunkenness as well. This idea that that was allowing him to kind of exist in this other world that was coming through in his writing.
So it was like a crutch or like a some access tool?
Well, I don't know if that's really true. I don't know though that Poe ever claimed that, but Baudelaire kind of advocated that as something... But again, I think it's because I think Poe becomes, for a lot of writers who like him, something other than what he is in some way, something that they can fit into their philosophy and notion of what writing should be, because it is so multifaceted, in some ways good, in some ways bad, that you can kind of pick up on what you want to pick up on out of it.
It's funny just how Poe's been taken as this really particular thing in folklore. I mean, I think Poe's character is like truly a folkloric character in people's minds, you know? Poe is like chalked up to this.
Well, and he was partially responsible for that, because I think in a lot of his writings in his lifetime, he purposely lied about some of his biographical details, made things seem different than they were.
They all do.
Which, yeah, I mean, that's the nature of... Well, even if you weren't trying to, you'd probably do that anyway. But I think he particularly fell into this kind of romanticized thing. And part of that, too, is I think he didn't get placed into the same sort of canon of early American writers that people like Hawthorne and Whitman did, right? Like, it's not the same kind of thing, right? Yes, everyone reads Poe in high school, but he seems almost... Where everyone else, they kind of... try to fit them into this spectrum of how did American literature develop, which is kind of a bullshit thing anyway. Poe almost always seems to be this weird thing that happened in the midst of that, that doesn't get connected into this movement.
He dodges it.
Yeah.
He's not placed within those contexts. And maybe that's why he stands out. You know, I think I keep coming back to the same thing, is like, okay, well, you know, Poe's valid in all these particular ways. You know, who holds him up, who praises him, and one thing, I found this interesting clip though. I'm gonna step over here with the mic here, and I'm gonna read a little clip. That's an interesting thing I found in relation to Harry Houdini. Is we were looking at this newspaper from February 8th, 1925, and actually, what drew me into the paper was a coverage of Abraham Lincoln's poetry, which we might catch up
we'll talk
in
about
another
that
episode.
Time, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
And in the back, but on the bottom of the front page, it says, you know, Harry Houdini boasts $250,000 Spook and Magic Library. So I'm reading the Spook and Magic Library article, and Jeff says he knew this, but I don't know if Jeff says he knew. He's like, oh, yeah, I knew that. I knew about Harry Houdini having Poe's writing desk. And I'm like, wait, there's no way you could have known this, because this seems like a fact that is eluded, has been like lost in time. But who knows? So this is from February 8th, 1925. Poe's writing desk. Another question concerned a small box of brown wood and metal corners, which looked as if it were about to slide off the pile of papers on a high shelf. "Oh, that's Poe's writing desk," the magician remarked, hunting through a pile of dog-eared envelopes for the Cagliostro letter.
Wait, so this is like a portable writing desk,
yeah.
I guess? Okay.
Houdini has insured his collections for about $350,000, he said, but if they burned, the insurance wouldn't do much good, he added, because most of the things would never be replaced. "I've been collecting them all my life. The first book I picked up myself was a 10% pamphlet I found in a little bookshop in Appleton, Wisconsin, the town where I was born. It was pilfered from the pages of a magician named Hoffman. My ambition, as far as I can remember, was to be a magician and also to fly an airship. I have done both. And I've been picking up books and papers ever since. Now I have accumulated such a mess of materials that I'm going to retire in 2 or 3 years and give the rest of my life to writing. I shall leave my library on psychic phenomenon, mediums, and spiritualism to the Psychic Research Society, my library and magic to the Congressional Library," which they still have it, by the way. "I have decided yet what will be done with the dramatic and criminology collections." But this is like, you know, so we've got this like learned, you know, sort of like crazy magician guy from the 1920s who owned Poe's writing desk. I really wonder where Poe's writing desk is now.
Yeah, that would be interesting. I wonder what happened to it.
If it ended up in the Library
of Congress.
I wonder
if it's in that. But there's that big Houdini Museum in that magic shop in New York. I wonder if they have it.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought there was another Houdini place in Pennsylvania somewhere, so I wonder if they have it. But
maybe one of those museums might have it. But it kind of makes sense, right, with Houdini's fascination with the supernatural in the other world. As much as he debunked a lot of spiritualist sort of things, he was very fascinated with that. So it makes sense. Like, Poe's kind of, as far as writing, is certainly the father of that kind of writing that's as actual literature dealing with that kind of subject matter, right?
It's perfect.
Yeah.
Poe would be an access point for Houdini.
Yeah.
To this other world. Like, something's there. Like, he's channeling something. Like, I could see Houdini is looking at that, as at Poe as like, okay, he's channeling. He's certainly channeling, you know?
That's pretty interesting.
Well, we could probably go into what else? We could play some music. We could go into
I don't know, somewhere in here, whether it's right now or not, we're gonna play some of that music that we recorded from the library. That's good.
The Sleeper. At midnight in the month of June, I stand beneath the mystic moon. An opiate vapor, dewy, dim, exhales from out her golden rim, and softly dripping, drop by drop, upon the quiet mountaintop, steals drowsily and musically into the universal valley. The rosemary nods upon the grave, the lily lolls upon the wave, wrapping the fog about its breast, the ruin molders into rest, looking like Leith, see? The lake a conscious slumber seems to take, and would not for the world awake. All beauty sleeps, and lo, where lies her casement open to the skies, Irene with her destinies. O lady bright, can it be right, this window open to the night? The wanton airs from the tree trop, laughingly through the lattice drop. The bottomless airs, a wizard rout, filled through thy chamber in and out, and wave the curtain canopy so fitfully, so carefully, above the closed and fringed lid, neath which thy slumbering soul lies hid, that o'er the floor and down the wall, like ghosts the shadows rise and fall. O lady dear, hast thou no fear? Why and what art thou dreaming here? Sure thou art come o'er far-off seas, a wonder to these garden trees. Strange is thy pallor, strange thy dress, strange above all thy length of tress, in this all solemn silentness. The lady sleeps, O may her sleep, which is enduring so be deep, heaven have her in its sacred keep, this chamber changed for one more holy, this bed for one more melancholy. I pray to God that she may lie forever with unopened eye while the dim sheeted ghosts go by. My love, she sleeps. Oh, may her sleep, as it is lasting, so be deep. Soft may the worms around her creep. Far in the forest, dim and old, for her may some tall vault unfold. Some vault that oft hath flung its black and winged panels fluttering back, triumphant o'er the crested palls of her grand family funerals. Some sepulchre, remote, alone, against whose portal she hath thrown in childhood many an idle stone. Some tomb from out whose sounding door she ne'er shall force an echo more. Thrilling to think, poor child of sin, it was the dead who groaned within.
All right.
Here we go.
Before we totally leave you today, we just wanted to, especially those of you who've listened to several episodes, if you haven't, go back and listen to some of the old episodes as well. It would really help us out if you could go onto iTunes and give us a review.
That would be fantastic. All we're asking for is to go through, access your iTunes podcasts, go in through the proper system.
Actually, you can make it even easier than that. All you have to do is type in nogoodpoetry.com/iTunes, and it will open your iTunes app for you and take you right to the podcast. And all you have to do is click on the review and enter the review. And really, the only reason, the way iTunes works, of course, is, you know, where a podcast gets listed is based on reviews as part of the algorithm, part of, you know, how high up it shows up. And we, you know, it would really help us get more listeners. But if you could give us a review. But yeah, tell your friends too. If you like the podcast, let them know. Get some more people listening to it.
All right. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Edgar Allan Poe.
And Edgar Allan Poe.
Edgar Allan Poe is like a demigod or like a god to me. He definitely influenced my whole life. I've read him since I was a child. Mm-hmm. Change my whole life as like I mean as young as I can remember. I remember my mom was obsessed with old movies and Turner Classic Movies, so like during Halloween, and it was like a tradition, so like roughly around like 3 or 4 I remember watching Turner Classic Movies and the Vincent Price reenactments of Poe's work, and just like realizing like this thing, it was like a fucked up spiritual thing. It wasn't like everything else. It was just like, what is going on? It was like another world
language,
and another world. It was just like so beyond like everything else. So basically from then on, like I don't know, that changed my life. As far as like Edgar Allan Poe, and then I got the books. I had several copies of his complete works, you know. Pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
It's insane too, like how he constantly changes. he's not, like, Edgar Allan Poe isn't, like, he's not that great of a poet, I'll give him that, but as a writer, like a story writer, like a telling stories, he's the best. There's kind of no one that touches him. What do you want to know about the music? We went way off. Okay, you want
to that far off. It's all right.
Yeah,
we'll bring
went
it back.
Way off. No one gives a shit. You want to talk about music?
I want to talk about what you have. What's your setup going to be at the Child Resource Center?
Children's Resource Center on Napoleon and Magazine. Okay, a Carnegie Building. I don't know what you're saying.
I keep forgetting. Sorry.
You keep forgetting.
My voice just keeps getting darker.
You ruined Christmas.
I didn't ruin Christmas.
Dude, you ruined God's name.
This might have to be the Christmas episode.
This is it. Okay. Aaron has a jean jacket.
Okay.
Ian Curtis died. We're all sad. Joseph looks like him. Ian Curtis
died for our sins.
Ian Curtis died for our sins and Joseph looks like him.
Should we make a t-shirt that says that?
Yeah. Please, God, make a t-shirt that
Ian
says
Curtis
that.
Died for our sins.
Ian Curtis died for our sins and Joseph looks like him.
No.
And a picture of Joseph with a haircut exactly like him. And then we would be the king of the hipsters.
Okay, we're going to edit this all out.
No, you gotta keep it in there.
Okay, so we gotta close it out here.
Okay.
So let's bring it back in so we can and begin.
Okay.
So let's go back to the music. What do you what's your setup gonna be at the Children's Resource Center?
The setup is going to be piano, electronics, and cello. And the beginning of the show is gonna have three pieces with piano and cello and some electronics that I did, and then the end of it is four pieces for just cello and electronics.
Okay, nice.
Yeah.
And then
the first piece, which is called Lenore, Joseph's reading on, and then after that it's just gonna be music.
Okay.
And then you and him are gonna read.
After that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
And it's three solo pieces and then with not solo pieces, three pieces with piano and cello and then and then four pieces with cello and electronics.
Okay.
That I wrote.
Nice.
Based off of Edgar Allan Poe.
Okay. Well, that sounds awesome. That sounds like it should be a good time. And if you're able to catch it, if you caught it, this podcast will come out after it, so that's fine. And we'll have recordings from it. So here you go.